Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
On the border in Tijuana, U.S. immigration policy has had a visible impact. Shelters once filled with asylum seekers are now deserted.
It's all empty. Beds are empty. The floor on the bottom is empty also.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today we come to you from the border to see what policy changes look like on the ground. Also on the show, 2 years of civil war in Sudan.
You're talking about a country that's been absolutely devastated in every sense of the word. The infrastructure, healthcare, education.
And in Iraq, a sandstorm has shut down airports and sent thousands to hospitals.
It gets literally everywhere. In your eyes, up your nose, inside your sleeping bag.
Plus, they come from across the globe, a new crop of players for the WNBA.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman.
We have a home away from home this week, broadcasting from the studios of KPBS in San Diego. Ahead this hour, we look at what's changed at the border with Tijuana, Mexico, since the Trump administration has enacted new border policies.
But we begin today in Sudan, marking 2 years since the start of the country's civil war, a war that has led to what's now considered the biggest humanitarian crisis on Earth. Today, on the war's second anniversary in London, British Foreign Minister David Lammy started proceedings.
Okay, colleagues, can I call everyone to attention as we focus on Sudan?
For a preliminary peace conference at a time when violence in Sudan is spiraling out of control.
Many have given up on Sudan. That is wrong.
Dalia Abdel-Moneim was living in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, when the conflict erupted. She was running a small bakery at the time. Now she lives in Cairo. Dalia has not given up on Sudan, but the current situation is far beyond what she could have imagined when she fled 2 years ago.
We all thought the war in a week will be over. They'll patch up their differences and everything will be back to normal. But it's 2 years today. And I'm a glasses half full type of person, but it keeps getting worse, you know. Every time I think we could be catching a break, something could happen, we get dragged into a deeper quagmire of war and conflict.
Please remind us how you left Khartoum 2 years ago.
Oh, God. Horrible conditions. I mean, our house was hit with a missile, so it rendered the place that we knew as safe. It was no longer safe. It took us a week to leave my house and to reach the outskirts of the capital, Khartoum. And we traveled for 2 days by bus to reach the eastern region of Sudan. And from there on, we all separated. We were around 30 family members, you know, extended and immediate. And everyone went off on their, you know, whichever route they could find. Me and my mother, and along with my sister, we ended up in Cairo. But I've kind of shut out that part. It's too traumatizing, too upsetting for me, because we also received a video of our neighborhood has in Khartoum has been liberated or recaptured by the army. I've been sent all the videos of our house. And I mean, our house is standing, but it's been violated. And in by extension, I've been violated because this is our home where we were born and raised and lived.
Yeah, it's really hard to hear about your house and the whole neighborhood. Earlier, you know, I said Sudan's now considered the world's largest humanitarian crisis. What goes through your mind when you hear people say that, when I said it?
For more than a year now, we've been saying this, you know, 14 million people displaced. 9 million children are out of school. Women are facing sexual violence and at such levels of cruelty that it's just unfathomable. Funding has kind of dried up. So far, they've only received 4% of the $6 billion required for the humanitarian situation in Sudan. And you're talking also about a group of people, specifically those from the Darfur region.
Well, we learned this week, as I'm sure you've read, that hundreds of people in Darfur have been killed after the paramilitary rapid support forces, the RSF, attacked two refugee camps. What have you been hearing about what's happening there in Darfur?
400,000 refugees have been forced to flee from these camps. These camps were housing up to 1.5 million people. And I think this is just the tip of the iceberg, simply because these attacks are ethnically driven. Because Darfur is made up of a multiple ethnic groups, but it's kind of divided into the Arab groups and the African ethnic groups. And the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, are unleashing pure hell on the African ethnic groups. They act like this because they have that sense of impunity, that nothing, they're untouchable. There has been no sanctioning of their backers of both these armies. More weapons has been flowing into Sudan.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that because, I mean, we come right down to it. Two rival generals are responsible for all this violence. One, the commander of the SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces. The other, the powerful paramilitary RSF. Both sides have wealthy international backers, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Smuggling gold is a huge export for Sudan. This is one of the reasons why both armies are able to supply their forces with weapons. There's a weapons embargoes over Darfur, but the weapons are flowing in from Darfur, from the western side, from Chad. And there's been a report by the UN released today by one of the British newspapers.
Yeah, it was in The Guardian.
Yes, that the UN fact-finding mission has said that the arms to the RSF are coming from the UAE. The UAE is supplying them.
Right. The United Arab Emirates officials there deny that. They say they're committed to bringing lasting peace to Sudan. What goes through your mind when you hear their proclamations?
I roll my eyes and I swear a lot because the evidence is there. The UAE is one of the main and largest sponsors, supplier and supporter of the Rapid Support Forces. The Sudanese army is not an innocent bystander. The Sudanese army has history, a very bloody history. But right now, what is happening under the RSF is something that we as Sudanese have never seen. And it's gone on to a whole new level of cruelty and depravity.
Dalia, you were part of the mass protest that toppled Sudan's longtime dictator, Omar al-Bashir, in 2019. There was hope in the air. How do you look back today on that time?
We were on such a high. We truly believed that this was a new, fresh start for all of us, that we could actually build something and move forward. And less than 4 years later, we are where we are right now, scattered, displaced, made refugees, having lost everything that we know, everything that we hold dear, having lost family members, friends and acquaintances to a senseless war. And here we are today.
Well, today on the second anniversary, the UK is hosting ministers from 20 countries in London to try to restart stalled peace talks. Realistically, Dalia, what are your hopes for those talks?
We get a lot of statements and we get a lot of nice words that Sudan is important and we cannot ignore it. But it has been ignored for the past 2 years. It has absolutely been ignored. And I wait. I mean, let's see. You never know. Maybe a miracle will happen. But neither of these two sides are willing to talk. They've crossed that threshold of being able to talk. They've reached a point where one of them has to emerge victorious. But the price of that victory, it will take a huge toll on all of us until we reach that point.
Do you still think about returning home?
I've never stopped thinking about returning home. But return to what? I mean, someone went to check up on our house and he told us that he couldn't last for longer than 40 minutes because of the stench of the decomposing bodies on the street. That's how bad it is. So how do we rebuild? It's going to take a long time. But I hope, you know, once I can guarantee that there is security and it's safe enough, I will go back just to see for myself. And then we can decide from there on what needs to be done.
Dalia Abdel-Monaim lived in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, before fleeing 2 years ago. She joined us today from Cairo on the two-year anniversary of the start of Sudan's civil war. Dalia, thank you very much. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you for having me.
He is known as God's architect. Antoni Gaudí was a Spanish architect famous for eye-catching structures throughout Barcelona, including his still unfinished Basilica of the Sagrada Familia. Now, Pope Francis has taken a first step toward canonizing Gaudí as a saint. Francis has declared Gaudí venerable in recognition of his heroic virtues. The architect died back in 1926. The movement to canonize him has been going on for decades, as the world's Jerry Haddon reported in 2009.
Y siempre pues estuvo muy...
He says Gaudí was always close to Christ. He wasn't an architect and then a Christian, but rather the other way around. He lived Christ in all aspects of his life.
For many who knew him, though, piety would not have been the first quality associated with Gaudí. That's according to historian Robert Hughes, speaking in a BBC documentary.
To work with, he was a nightmare. He was short-tempered. He was arrogant. He treated workers with considerable contempt. He did all the things that demanding, brilliant maestros are in the bad habit of doing.
Still, reverence for Gaudí is widespread in Spain and beyond. But that does not necessarily translate to saintliness. Here's what one Spaniard told the World.
I'm a fellow artist, and in terms of Gaudí's art, I think he's amazing. But a saint? I'm not so sure.
Now that Pope Francis has declared Gaudí venerable, the next step is beatification, and that requires proof of a miracle. Whether Gaudí's architecture is miraculous or not has yet to be determined.
Late last night, prisons across France came under attack. Outside the prisons, people burned cars and vandalized walls. In the southern city of Toulon, someone opened fire with an automatic weapon. Authorities believe the attacks were coordinated, but it is still a mystery who's behind them. The World's Jerry Haddon has more.
The gray metal front gate at the Toulon penitentiary is not bulletproof. 15 rounds from an AK-47 assault rifle went right through it, leaving gaping holes.
Heureusement que derrière la porte, on n'avait pas de personnel, parce que comme ça traversait.
Prison worker whose identity was not revealed on French television said luckily no one was standing behind the doors last night when the attackers opened fire. It could have been much worse, he said. None of our staff were killed or injured. But after a night of what appears to have been premeditated attacks on 7 prisons across the country, prison staff are scared. They've burned our cars, one employee told a reporter, hiding her face. Who's to say they won't come after us in our homes? To allay those fears, France's Justice Minister, Gérald Darmanin, traveled to Toulon today. There, he assured prison staff.
Ce matin, j'ai demandé au ministre de l'Intérieur de mobiliser tous les moyens auprès des préfets.
This morning, I ordered the Interior Minister to stop at nothing to provide constant security around our prisons. As for staff, he said, he's proposing giving them constant protection, too, at work and at their homes. Don't worry, he told them, the police always win. The police are gathering evidence and following a few clues. The most obvious is an acronym spray-painted on prison facades last night, DDPF, or For the Rights of French Prisoners, in French. DDPF is associated with a shadowy French anarchist group that opposes jails in general. But anarchists and AK-47s, that doesn't add up, says Damanin. He suspects narco-traffickers. Just this week, he'd announced tough new measures to shut down their networks by isolating the most dangerous dealers in new maximum security prisons starting this summer and taking away their telephones for real.
L'enquête le dira, mais il se trouve que...
These new measures are very tough, he said. The investigation will clear this up, but the timing of these attacks cannot be coincidence. The level of coordination of these attacks has caught the eye of anti-terrorism experts, too. They're now also investigating, but so far at least the evidence is scarce.
Des individus sont arrivés sur le parking, ont crié des choses qu'ils ne peuvent pas déterminer.
One witness, prison union leader Laure Cassier, said the attackers were yelling something, but we couldn't hear what. Then they lit our cars on fire and were gone. Cassier was referring to an attack on Sunday night in the city of Agen, where 7 cars were set alight at France's National School for Prison Administration. Investigators believe that attack is related. So far, no arrests have been made. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
It gets in your eyes, scrapes your skin, and can make it hard to breathe. We're talking about sandstorms that are hitting parts of Iraq this week. That is just ahead. You are listening to The World.
Hey, this is David Rind. I'm an audio producer at CNN. And one of my favorite things about working at CNN is that I can call up our super smart correspondents and reporters whenever I want to pick their brains about the news and the stories they're covering. Well, I want to bring you in on those conversations with our podcast, CNN One Thing. Each week, I grab one of those said reporters and we break down one big story that's been making headlines. Again, the podcast is CNN One Thing. Listen on your favorite podcast app.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. A sandstorm has blanketed parts of southern Iraq in an orange haze. The sand and dust being whipped around have sent thousands of Iraqis to ERs seeking urgent treatment for breathing problems. The storm has also caused flights to be canceled. Sandstorms are not new to Iraq, but they're getting worse. Nicholas Middleton is a geographer at Oxford who specializes in desertification and sandstorms. He started by describing what sandstorms are like.
A really severe one can reduce visibility virtually to zero. Depending on where the dust comes from, there's often a sort of orangey, reddy haze to the atmosphere, which is caused by iron on the dust particles. It can be pretty if you're inside and looking out through a closed window, but jolly dangerous if you're outside and caught in it.
What does that feel like to be outside in a sandstorm? I gather you have experienced that.
I have experienced it, and the short answer is very unpleasant.
Okay.
I was caught in a sandstorm in Niger in West Africa on the edge of the Sahara some 20-odd years ago now. I was asleep right on a sand dune, and the wind whipped up, and you get literally sandblasted by these very small particles, small but hard particles. And all you can do is try and take cover, put something over your head, for example, because it gets literally everywhere, in your eyes, up your nose, inside your sleeping bag, inside your socks, you name it, you find dust and sand particles there the next morning when it's all over. So deeply unpleasant experience.
And do we know what has caused this current sandstorm in Iraq?
It's the beginning of the sandy, dusty season in that part of the world. And in short, you need a number of factors to be aligned, which are a strong wind, bare, dry soil surfaces unprotected by vegetation. So in Iraq, Syria, the Persian Gulf area, this is the beginning of the dusty season. And it spreads from now, sort of April, May type time, all the way through to August, September. So this is probably the first big one in Iraq for this season, but it's unlikely to be the last.
And you've mentioned dry conditions and land cover. Are those part of the explanation of why this region is seeing more sandstorms?
Yeah, so during drought periods, you certainly get more. Many of the dust storms in Iraq come either from the floodplain of the Tigris-Euphrates, the two big rivers in that part of the world, which are farmed, and or from farmland on the border between Syria and Iraq. So multiple factors, dry conditions, which are seasonal, droughts, which occur every few years, abandoned land and abandoned farmland can easily become dusty sources. Of course, we've had civil unrest for a lengthy period, particularly up on the border with Syria, and that doesn't help because farmers aren't tending their fields. Mm. So multiple different factors driving sand and dust storms in that part of the world.
You mentioned drought, which, of course, climate change is making more frequent in many parts of the world. Is there a clear signal here between climate change and increasing sandstorms?
It would be nice if it was clear, but unfortunately it's not. In one sense, yes, we can expect more sand and dust storms if droughts become more frequent, more severe, and more prolonged, which is predicted. However, there are other factors involved. There's a phenomenon called global stilling, which in recent decades means that the strength of the winds blowing is not as great as it has been in the past. There's also more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is good for plant growth, and plants protect soil surfaces. So trying to disentangle these multiple factors is by no means straightforward.
Are there countries in the Middle East that get sandstorms that are working together, sort of cross-border, to tackle this?
Yeah, interestingly enough, there's a project which started a year or two ago, financed by the Kuwaitis, who are directly in the firing line of a lot of long-range transport of dust from Iraq and Syria. And the Kuwaitis are financing an effort to try and stabilize an area that's produced a lot of these dust storms in the past in southern Iraq. So they're working with farmers to try and plant windbreaks and create barriers to protect soil surfaces. So there's some cross-border management of the situation there. And there are also efforts in the wider part of the Middle East, because these events from Syria, Iraq blow straight down the Persian Gulf. So they affect Kuwait, they affect Qatar, the UAE, parts of Saudi Arabia. So they're all in it together. And the more they can do to coordinate actions and share resources and ideas and knowledge and information, the better chance they will have, because these are transboundary issues. No one country can solve them on their own.
Nicholas Middleton is a physical geographer at the University of Oxford.
Last night, the WNBA drafted 38 new athletes. It was a dream come true for some of the world's most talented basketball players. Nearly half of the first-round draft picks are international. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
The NCAA is responsible for training and developing some of the biggest names in sports. But some athletes don't need the college system to go pro.
With the second pick in the 2025 WNBA draft, the Seattle Storm select Dominique Malunga from France.
19-year-old Dominique Malunga is a 6'6" center who is actually already a pro in Europe and has played for France in the Olympics. In the WNBA, though, she says she'll also represent Cameroon and Congo, where her family's from. She even draped their flags over her table at last night's draft.
I'm a multicultural person. I have a lot of people behind me, and I'm so proud to be here and to represent all of them.
Malunga is sure to garner a U.S. fan base when she steps onto the court, as she's known for putting on a show by dunking on her opponents. Another African country, Nigeria, was center stage just a few minutes later.
The Washington Mystics select Okikiola Iriafen, University of Southern California.
Iriafen did play college hoops in the U.S., but she wanted to make sure her Nigerian roots were on display on the big stage. To do that, she wore a custom gown by Nigerian designer Nekasi Alexander.
The dress itself was bronze. It had a bronze corset, and then the bottom part of it was gold with bronze jewels dripping from the dress.
Alexander told me different elements of the dress represent the two Nigerian tribes that Iriafen's parents are from. For example, her father is from the Edo tribe or kingdom.
So when you think of kingdom, you think of opulence, you think of wealth, you think of luxury. We needed to reflect that in her dress in the form of thousands of embellished details.
Other international first-round draft picks include Georgia Amor from Australia, Aisha Siuka from Slovenia, and Juste Josite from Lithuania.
Josite su kamuoliu ir pirmasis metimas taikliai. Bravo.
Josite joined Lithuania's senior national team when she was just 13 years old. Now 19, she's the first Lithuanian drafted into the WNBA since 2000. She's going to the Golden State Valkyries, the newest team in the league. But two more teams are coming next year, one in Portland and one in Toronto. That'll be the first WNBA team outside the U.S. All these new teams mean more roster spots to fill and more opportunities for international players. The 2025 season, full of fresh faces, starts next month. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. As we broadcast from Southern California this week, we turn our attention to the border with Mexico. Tijuana has long been a crossroads for migrants headed to the United States.
But new policies under the Trump administration have changed that. And in Tijuana, just on the other side of the border from us here in San Diego, the difference is noticeable. The World's Mexico correspondent, Tibi Saizea, is in Tijuana and brings us this report.
In cities across northern Mexico, one thing is hard to miss. The migrants are gone. in Tijuana, parks, hotels, and vacant buildings that were usually filled with migrant families now look deserted. Pastor Alberto Rivera runs a shelter in Tijuana with a capacity for 1,300 people.
Everything was full, hasta teníamos tents.
Just over a year ago, he says, every corner of the space was packed, with tents filling the basketball court. But now,
it's all empty.
He points to bunk beds unused, tables sitting empty at mealtime. Only 31 people are sheltering here. The scene from Pastor Rivera's shelter is not unique. Father Pat Murphy is the director of La Casa del Migrante, or the Migrant's House, one of the oldest shelters operating in Tijuana.
Well, they stopped coming because they have no hope for asylum right now. There's no system for asylum. People sometimes still show up and say, well, we're going to give ourselves up and ask for asylum. That doesn't work anymore. They'll just deport you and give you an order that you can't come back for 10 years.
He says those who remain are among the most vulnerable, especially people targeted by organized crime who in normal circumstances would qualify for asylum. But they are now stuck between difficult choices, debating the risks of returning home or crossing illegally, even while the border has become militarized.
Oh yeah, there's still some people who think they can do it. And the smugglers will say, yes, we could do it. And they'll charge them up to $15,000. That's the number we've been hearing recently. But it seems pretty much impossible.
To make things worse, funding cuts by the Trump administration are impacting many organizations devoted to helping migrants.
We lost about 40% of our budget thanks to all the cuts that Trump has made to foreign aid. And we have just begun to tell people we can no longer afford to pay them.
Many shelters in border cities were expecting to receive massive numbers of deportees from the U.S. In Tijuana, the Mexican government rented a huge building with capacity to host 2,500 deportees. But only about 100 Mexicans are being deported to Tijuana every day, mostly people who just tried crossing the border and who quickly find their way back to their home states. For decades, dozens of organizations in Tijuana have assisted people wanting to seek asylum in the U.S.
In April 24th, in just a couple of weeks, we'll celebrate our 38th anniversary. 270,000 people have come through the doors of this casa, and we don't want to close it.
Father Murphy says future migrants or deportees could be left without vital support. Alberto Martin, the evangelical pastor, says his shelter is also at risk of closing. He's a U.S. citizen and says he wants President Trump to know that he voted for him. He was hoping he could crack down on organized crime and human smugglers in the area. But now he's regretting it. I didn't vote for this, he says. For the world, I'm Tibi Saicea, Tijuana.
And we're right across the border in San Diego. Gustavo Solis is a reporter here at KPBS. He has been covering immigration issues in the area for almost 10 years. Gustavo, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what policies did the Trump administration put in place that have caused these changes that TV just reported on in Tijuana?
The big one, I think, was eliminating CBP-1 app as a way to get into the country to pursue asylum claims. The Biden administration had really pushed this app. If you remember back in June when there were images of encampments along the border and a lot of people were crossing at once, especially in Texas, the Biden administration decided to stop that chaos by saying, no, if you cross illegally, you won't have the same access to asylum that you had before. We really want you to use this mobile app. And with this app, you can stay in Mexico, you can wait, you can sign up for an appointment. We give you a date, and on that date of your appointment, you can come and enter legally and pursue your claim that way. Overnight, Trump ended that policy. Biden had already made it very difficult to cross illegally and pursue asylum. So by the time Trump came, all he had to do was eliminate the app. And that, in practice, eliminated humanitarian protection along the southern border.
So what does that mean for San Diego in terms of the number of arrivals here?
Well, they're at historic lows. San Diego is not a destination in the way Boston would be or other major cities like Los Angeles, Chicago, New York. Something like 95% of all the migrants who crossed illegally here in San Diego during that time, they were here two or three days, and then they left to their final destination. The biggest difference we're seeing now is a shift in enforcement from the border to internal enforcement. So that would be like the ICE raids we're seeing, workplace raids, different things like that.
Something we've reported on before is falls along or down from the border wall that can cause serious injuries. Are those down also as crossing attempts are down?
Yeah, we had here in San Diego three consecutive years, record years, of people hospitalized from falling from the border wall. This was largely a result of the first Trump administration's border wall that raised the height significantly. So falling from that height, before it was minor injuries, now it was fatal injuries. Like there are people with multiple broken bones, really severe head trauma going to the hospital. And it was 3 years in a row of record hospitalization after record hospitalization after record hospitalization. Now it's very, very minimal. I think last month there were only two cases, which that hadn't happened since before 2017.
Mm. I understand that the military is playing a slightly different role or more of a role than it has before at the border. Can you explain what they're doing?
Yeah, it's kind of ironic that the military is here now because there's fewer folks crossing. A lot of it is auxiliary work, support work for Border Patrol folks. Some of the things they do, put barbed wire across the border. They will work as lookouts, so they'll just kind of stand watch, patrolling different areas of the border. They will drive Border Patrol agents around. The one thing they won't do, and I think that's because of federal law, because they can't do law enforcement, they're military, they can't put their hands on people, arrest people and do things like that. But they can do everything else that will free up personnel, resources, and time for Border Patrol so they can direct more of their agents to do that kind of work.
So if the region has way fewer people trying to cross at the land border, are people now looking for alternate ways to get into the U.S. around San Diego?
There are still crossing attempts. They can kind of go through the desert. Maritime attempts have been really high the last couple of years as people either trying to swim across or getting a boat to drop themselves up in the northern part of the county as well. But again, we have seen lower crossing throughout. I was speaking to a reporter from the AP the other day who has covered this longer than I have. And he did point out that we saw a similar trend in the first couple of months of the previous Trump administration, where January, February, March, we saw a really sharp decline. And part of that at the time was attributed to the Mexican coyotes, the human smugglers, taking a pause, you know, breathing it in, waiting to see how enforcement happens, and then coming up with different methods to cross. So we could be seeing something similar right now. Nobody expects the numbers to stay as low as they have been for a long time because, just frankly, that really hasn't happened historically.
You mentioned an increase in maritime crossings the past few years. Is that something that you've seen or reported on directly?
Yeah, I have. We actually did a story going down to Tijuana, speaking to the lifeguards over there. So talking to lifeguards on both sides of the border, talking about some of the rescues that they've made.
Mm.
But even just me personally, like I live in Ocean Beach here in San Diego, 20, 25 miles from the border. And a few months ago, I was just walking down the beach, and I did see a boat that was carrying migrants capsized.
Mm.
And it turned out into like a rescue situation, but it was really interesting to see because you had local surfers go to the boat and help people with their surfboards who couldn't really swim. There were older folks struggling to walk on the sharp rocks, and you saw little kids going over there and try to help them down. So you saw the community respond that way. And then once they got into the beach, they went their own way.
Huh. You mentioned that border crossings, you don't expect them to be as low as they are now for long. Is there something that the community here does expect to see, you know, sort of months and months into the second Trump administration?
I think something they're looking at, especially the local advocates, they're looking to see how mass deportations happen. Because we have seen an increase in arrests. More people are being detained. ICE detention is at capacity, but that hasn't translated to more deportations or what we would expect when Trump called for historic deportations. When it does begin, I think it'll be interesting to see how ready folks are for it.
If it does begin.
If it does. Yeah, if and when it does begin.
Yeah. Gustavo Solis is the border reporter at KPBS. Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Thank you.
Tijuana is Mexico's second largest city, so you know there's a lot more going on there than the stories that usually make the U.S. headlines. Tomorrow we hit a couple of Tijuana's venerated record shops to flip through vinyl and hear about the thriving music scene there.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
The UK says it can keep producing steel in the coming weeks as it tries to take control of British Steel away from its Chinese owners. That's due to concerns about Chinese investment in strategic industries. The Chinese Foreign Ministry warned this week against politicizing steel.
A Peruvian court today sentenced former President Ollanta Humala to 15 years in prison for money laundering. He used funds from a construction firm to finance two political campaigns. He is the third former Peruvian president to be imprisoned for corruption in the past two decades.
And two Belgian teenagers were charged in Nairobi, Kenya today with trafficking ants. Authorities had found them with thousands of ants packed in test tubes. They told the judge they did not know collecting ants is illegal. Kenyan authorities say it's part of a trend, trafficking smaller and lesser-known wildlife species.
And those are a few things you might have missed.
The Himalayan Kingdom of Bhutan is one of the tiniest nations in the world, and it's planning a mega city that aspires to a utopian ideal. Reporter Sushmita Patak reports from the site of the proposed city in Gelefu, Bhutan.
I'm riding uphill on a bumpy road near the town of Gelefu in south-central Bhutan. Signs by the road caution drivers about crossing elephants. The drive leads to a vantage point overlooking a vast flat expanse. You can hear peacocks in the background. There are areca nut farms, banana plantations. This lush rural landscape near Bhutan's border with India is going to be part of the Gelefu Mindfulness City. It's slated to become a sprawling economic hub, strategically located between two giants, India and China, as this promotional video claims.
Bhutan is focused on building its future, ready to emerge as the gateway between South Asia and the world.
The new city will aim to be climate-friendly, like the rest of Bhutan, the world's first carbon-negative country. It will also be rooted in Buddhist teachings. Rapsal Dorji manages communications for Gelefu Mindfulness City, or GMC.
With the GMC, we're also looking at making sure that we have economic growth, prosperity that is in tune and in line with our deeply held core values around mindfulness and sustainability and spirituality.
So what will that look like? I asked Bjark Ingels, the architect and master planner of the Mindfulness City.
The tallest buildings are 6 to 8 stories, but typically as the buildings climb the foot of the mountains, they become smaller and smaller. You have people living among rice fields.
Buildings will be made of locally available materials like river rocks and bamboo timber, he says. Bridges over the many streams that crisscross this area will double as universities or Buddhist spirituality centers. And the airport, Ingels says, will feel like an extension of the surrounding forest.
On one hand, it's going to feel like almost ancient, and on the other hand, incredibly futuristic.
While it might sound utopian, the Mindfulness City is a measured response to Bhutan's economic misery, says Aditya Gaudara Shivamurthy. He's a South Asia expert at the Observer Research Foundation in India. The COVID pandemic hurt tourism, a key sector of the Bhutanese economy, and a lack of jobs has been driving young people out of the country in large numbers.
Bhutan needs economic diversification, and this is just one more tactic of its economic diversification.
Bhutan is often called the land of happiness because of its focus on Buddhist teachings. But it also wants to be rich, Shivamurthy says, and that's where the Mindfulness City comes in. The project is the brainchild of King Jigme Khesar Namgyel Wangchuk, who's Bhutan's head of state. He unveiled his vision for the Mindfulness City in his National Day address in December 2023.
An economic corridor. Southeast Asia, the Garina Zujovachin, Machi Gelefu Berusam.
Speaking in a mix of English and Dzongkha, the king told Bhutan's youth that the Mindfulness City would create jobs and encourage those living abroad to return home. The Bhutanese public is rallying behind his vision. Land prices in Gelefu have already shot up. But there's also a bit of nervousness. Dozens of potted plants adorn Ganga Tamang's front yard in Gelefu. The soft-spoken woman sits behind the counter of her grocery shop. She doesn't know much about the Mindfulness City, but worries about how it will affect her future. I spoke to her through a translator.
Now that she has constructed her house, established her business, and then suddenly, if the GMC accuses it, yeah, she has anxiety where to go, what to do.
Details about how locals will be relocated are still being worked out, says Dr. Lotte Shering, the governor of the Mindfulness City and Bhutan's former prime minister. But he assured me that this was on the top of his mind.
His Majesty has made a very clear command. We have to strategize in a very unique way that everybody is happy. Everybody stands to benefit.
The Mindfulness City will welcome everyone, he says, both Bhutanese and expats. They can be innovators, investors, academics, even retirees.
Infrastructure building should be completed within 10 years' time from now. We are targeting about 1 million population.
1 million people. That's more than the entire population of Bhutan. An ambitious goal. But smart cities around the world often fall short of their shiny targets. Take Saudi Arabia, whose new city Neom has been drastically scaled back. I asked the governor if he's concerned about that.
Biggest reason why all these initiatives have failed or not doing as per their original plan. Of the many, one, continuity in the leadership.
Meaning, a government starts a project, but when it's voted out, the new leaders do something different. The governor is confident that won't happen with the Mindfulness City because it will become an autonomous region. Basically, a country within a country.
Whoever wants to work with GMC can work for generations. Need not worry about elections. Need not worry about political leadership.
On the streets of Gelifu, the non-stop chirping of Myna birds reigns supreme. For now, the modest town sits in stark contrast to the renderings of the Mindfulness City and the riches it could bring. For the world, I'm Sushmita Pathak, Gelifu, Bhutan.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, broadcasting from San Diego. Known to some as America's finest city, also America's finest baseball team is here, the San Diego Padres. They've got the best record in the major league right now. Locals are stoked. Sports fans everywhere share passions, rituals, even a belief that a team's home turf is sacred ground. That's what reporter Lautaro Grinspan discovered when he visited Argentina's most venerated soccer stadium in December.
On game days, supporters of the local soccer team, Boca Juniors, take over the streets wearing yellow and dark blue. Andres Escobar drove 250 miles to be part of the gathering. This is the party, he says. This is part of the folklore of Boca. They rally in the streets for hours, and then the fans will head toward the team's home stadium, which is also one of Buenos Aires' most iconic monuments. It's called La Bombonera. Painted blue and yellow, the Bombonera isn't modern or glitzy. It's not even the city's biggest stadium. But this 84-year-old structure has built a legacy as the liveliest place to watch soccer. Its unique architecture has something to do with it. The stands are dizzyingly steep, which allows fans to pack in close to the action. In Argentina, many people say soccer is the country's national religion. If that were true, then the Bombonera would be its holy see. It helps that the stadium was for a long time the professional home of soccer legend Diego Maradona. Maradona passed in 2020, but there are shrines in his honor across the country. In adjacent balconies facing the Bombonera, a life-sized replica of the revered soccer star stands next to that of another famous Argentine, Pope Francis. Pablo Lisotto covers Boca Juniors for Argentina's biggest newspaper, La Nación.
Es de alguna manera una experiencia religiosa.
Attending a game at the Bombonera makes for a near religious experience, he says. Fans get so excited, jumping and cheering, that they make the stands feel like they are shaking. Tickets can be very expensive.
Pero vale la pena cada centavo.
But it's worth every cent, he says. Perhaps no one embodies the devotion of the fans inside the Bombonera better than Carlos Arnaiz. A 72-year-old accountant, Arnaiz first watched a Boca game in the stadium in 1968. Since then, he has missed just a couple of the more than 1,000 games that have been held at the Bombonera. It's like Sunday Mass, he says. The Bombonera is a mystical place. It's a temple. To miss a Boca game, for me, it's sacrilegious. It's a stain on my resume as a fan. During games, Arnaiz doesn't just sit back and watch. Instead, he belts out Pro Boca chants. His singing has earned him a nickname, the tenor of the Bombonera.
Como no voy a ser, como no voy a ser, hincha de Boca, vago y atorrante.
So, can sporting fandom be compared to a religious faith? Rebecca Alpert, a professor of religion at Temple University, says the answer is yes.
It gives us what I call the three B's. It's a place to believe, it's a way to behave, and it's a way to belong. And if you think about religion functioning that way, then sport is absolutely, for many people, functions as a religion in their lives.
For diehard fans like those in Argentina and elsewhere, stadiums can hold extraordinary meaning.
I watched people walk into baseball parks and just had this experience of feeling like they are in a place where they experience transcendence. They speak of the beauty of the place and the meaning of the place.
Sport is like religion in another important way, Alpert said. Both institutions give people a space where they can come together and commune with one another. That can be a big deal for societies as polarized as the US's and Argentina's. Back outside the Bombonera, Boca fans said that love for their team transcends class, politics, and generations. We don't treat people differently here, Boca fan Manuel Alfaro said. We all have the same jersey. We're all blue and yellow. Whenever he gets to witness a win in the stadium, Alfaro says he feels like he's floating for at least a week afterward. Arnaiz, the tenor of the Bombonera, says he feels drained, happy but drained. The emotions are too intense, he says.
¿Cómo no voy a ser si soy de Boca y tengo aguante?
Wow.
For the world, I'm Lautaro Greenspan, Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Lautaro's story is part of our reporting project on sacred spaces around the globe. Check out more stories and photos of La Bombonera at theworld.org.
Before we sign off, one quick final stop in Montevideo, the capital of Uruguay. Producer Phil Corbett brings us this audio postcard capturing a traveler's poetic impression of the city.
A vertical line from the map sprawled out in front of the taxi windshield, lined tight with colonial facades, sloping slowly and then abruptly into the delta. Montevideo was a city asleep. A city asleep, but dreaming wildly. At sunset, cells of drummers congealed into clots in the warm, narrow streets and erupted into the veins, pumping fluid rhythm, a parade of dancing women and flags and camera phones and cautious dogs in tow. A man sat side saddle on a sputtering scooter and whistled songs steeped in a sorrow he was not outwardly experiencing. He was asleep too. The sun was behind schedule and meant to set around 9, but became lazier each day, arriving late to its night job elsewhere. I slept in. I ate whenever. I sat on the cement wall at the coastline. Plastic bags bobbed in the water. Yesterday's news bobbed in the water. The men and the children bobbed in the water. A distant freighter stood still in the water. The city didn't wake up before I left, so I left a note in the Delta and walked to the bus stop.
These stories, Postcards from the Wind, are produced by Phil Corbett. Hear more at thewind.org.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX. Broadcasting today from the Catherine and James Whistler studio at KPBS in San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider, and Marianne Tagney. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.